is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. A recent study out of the Criminal Justice Policy Program at Harvard Law School finds stark racial disparities in the Massachusetts criminal justice system. Here's how one of the researchers, Felix Owusu, a PhD student in public policy at Harvard, breaks it down.
Black and Latinx people facing drug or weapons charges are more likely to be convicted. They're more likely to be incarcerated than white people facing similar charges, and they do also receive longer sentences.
The study was commissioned by the late Supreme Judicial Court Chief Justice Ralph Gantz, who died this week. Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins wrote an opinion piece in the Boston Globe in response to the study and joins us on the line now. Welcome back, DA Rollins.
How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
I am looking forward to speaking with you about the study and its implications, but I do want to start, as we noted, the study was commissioned by Chief Justice Gantz. He passed away earlier this week. What's your reaction to his passing?
We have lost a giant. I mean, he was just such a brilliant and kind man. He was moving so quickly before many of us did. 4 years ago, he asked that this Harvard Law School study happened before many individuals were talking about the racial disparities, well before, you know, I had even thought about running for DA. He was just a champion of these issues. I think it speaks so much about how important cultural competency is with respect to the judiciary, and we will have some incredibly large shoes to fill if they could even be filled now that he's gone.
You know, Governor Charlie Baker is now in a position to have appointed all members of the Supreme Judicial Court. What will you be looking for in his nominee to replace Chief Justice Gantz and for the overall structure of the court? He has two nominations he'll be in a position to make.
Yeah, so that is just unheard of, right? I think the last time that happened, somebody said it was John Hancock, and they weren't joking. And I think it was only five justices on the court at the time. But Governor Baker is in an incredibly unique position where he will have appointed all seven. And we hope that he is going to not only look for exceptionally, bright and capable and able individuals, but individuals with a broad range of life experiences and work experiences. So if we look at our court right now, I think I saw a statistic, it's over 328, I believe, years old now. There have been 10 women on the court since the beginning since its inception. Three Black Americans or individuals have been on that court. Exactly zero Latinx individuals have been appointed to that court. We had, of course, the fabulous Judge Duffley, who was on the court and is a woman of color, an Asian woman. But we don't have a lot of racial and ethnic diversity. We also don't have many criminal defense attorneys. We don't have many individuals that have represented the indigent. And remember, Tiziana, that they are the ones that are in court every day with the prosecutors. I think five of the seven are former prosecutors. Of course, Chief Justice Gantz served with distinction, I believe, at the U.S. Attorney's Office and was the head of the public integrity division there. But we need to make sure we are looking. And then we have made great decisions in the past with respect to Chief Justice Marshall and Justice Cordy, neither of whom had served as judges prior to being appointed to the Supreme Judicial Court. So the governor has a lot of opportunity here. He, I know, is taking this incredibly seriously. I've had multiple conversations with his chief counsel, Bob Ross, about this, as well as the head of the Judicial Nominating Commission. So I know he's taking this seriously, and I have every faith in the fact that he's going to try to fill these enormous shoes well with respect to Chief Justice Gantz and also the retirement of Justice Link.
Let's turn now to Chief Justice Gantz's legacy, specifically this study, which, as you pointed out, he commissioned in 2016, 4 years ago. So this study found that Black and Latinx people are convicted and incarcerated at rates higher than their white counterparts, receive disproportionately longer sentences for similar offenses, and that is true even though they make up a minority of the state's population. I think the first thing I want to ask you is, are you surprised by any of those findings?
No, I'm not. And I think that there are many poor people or black and brown individuals who have come in contact with the criminal legal system who are not at all surprised by this information. What I was surprised about was just the complete lack of responsiveness of certain members of law enforcement and the lack of data, the gaping holes we had with respect to data regarding, you know, all of the information that Harvard Law School was looking at.
So let's talk about that, because you co-wrote a piece in the Boston Globe about data and transparency in the criminal justice system in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Jumping off from the study and expressing some of that dismay, I want to note State Representatives Byron Rushing and Juana Matias were part of that. What data do you think we need that we don't have? Fair. What data do you think we don't have that we need, and how do we get that? I mean, that seems like an important but big lift, D.A. Rollins.
Yeah, so what is great is our legislature has actually done tremendously great work in laying out what we are supposed to do regarding the collection of data. And so there are specific sections that tell us explicitly what we're supposed to be looking at. So, for example, whether or not there is a, you know, we're going to track individuals using a single common identifier, so that if Rachel Rollins is going through the criminal legal system, I have one number, whether it is used by the Boston police when they arrest me, the DA's office and CPCS when they defend me or prosecute me, probation, the trial, you know, all of these different players in the system. And then ultimately when I get charged or, you know, found not guilty or whatever the result is, when I get charged, when I go into the Department of Corrections system or the House of Corrections, depending on what I am charged with, is there one single standardized sort of common identifier so that we can find Rachel when we need her? And we've seen, you know, that is not happening.
Is that done in other states? Are there other states that have done that successfully, that level of sort of data tracking?
So we know, for example, that there are several other states, I believe Pennsylvania and other and a few others, that the assistant district attorneys receive all of their documents electronically from their law enforcement partners. Remember that we, as the DA's office, I don't arrest people. When I'm indigent as an individual that's been charged with a crime, it's not the DA's office that is saying, write down all of your financial information to see if you're indigent. There are all these other entities that have all of this information about an individual that comes in contact with the system, that we as the DA's office are out here with our hands outstretched, right, saying, please, please give us this data. We are getting paper records every day and waiting for those things. In Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, assistant district attorneys are getting all that information uploaded. They have it immediately, and members of law enforcement are speaking with each other. You know, so for me, I look at this and say, we have other states we can look to. And part of what we said, the three authors of this op-ed, is, you know, this, we are Massachusetts. We are leading the world with respect to, you know, technology and innovation and data and transparency and many other realms. But we are failing, and I include myself in this, are failing when it comes to data and transparency regarding the criminal legal system. And, you know, I do want to make sure that we are clear, though, that there has been a lot of money put into the courts and probation. I believe recently they received hundreds of millions of dollars for their databases, and they aren't sharing information with us.
I want to pick it up there. I actually want to pivot, because we have limited time, and there's some other things about the study that I'd like to talk to you about. Controlling for other factors, we know that Black and Latinx people, as the study says, quote, are still sentenced to 31 and 25 days longer than their similarly situated white counterparts. That's after controlling for demographics, criminal history, etc. We also learned from the study that charging differences, that the initial charging differences, so how severe the crime you were charged for, had a lot to do with what happened further down the criminal justice pipeline in terms of sentencing outcomes, your ability to enter plea bargaining, your ability to be deferred into something other than the criminal justice process. That is both a policing and a prosecution factor. So what do prosecutors need to do differently, and what do you want to do differently in your office?
You're absolutely right. This is not just the police. And so these are initial charges. Depending on how many we charge you with and the type of things we charge you with, the study showed that Black and Latinx individuals are usually charged with superior court level charges, right, where there's exclusive jurisdiction in superior court, as opposed to a district court where there might be concurrent jurisdiction between a district or municipal court and a superior court, or certain drug and weapon offenses, or even mandatory minimums. So what I have to do is teach my assistant district attorneys, as well as, you know, my counterparts do, about what are the implicit biases that we have internally, right? That we are looking at this defendant and thinking that they should be charged with something more significant than maybe somebody in the exact same situation. And what's fascinating is, even with the regression analysis, you are right. We saw 31 and 25 more days regarding Black and Latinx individuals. So I think we have to start talking more about race. And what you need to recognize is there are a lot of people that are incredibly uncomfortable discussing race, because they think by having a discussion about race, we are calling you racist. And that is not, in fact, the case. But we are well beyond the place where people's feelings about being hurt, right, because we're talking about race, is in no way going to trump the real and documented harm that Black and Latinx individuals and poor people are experiencing every single day in our criminal legal system.
So what does that look like in your office? What do you do in your office to begin to grapple with the implicit bias behind decision-making, to have these conversations about race, and to counteract criticisms you will undoubtedly get from those who believe that these disparities come from core behaviors and not racism in the system, although that is not what the study finds?
Yes, it's not what the study finds. And, you know, also we have it goes all back to data, where we can actually track things and show, no, we did a regression analysis and we pulled all of those things out and we still saw this disparity. So what have I done? You know, I'm proud that I'm the first woman that's ever been elected DA in the history of Suffolk County, right? Dating back to 1806 is when our office started, literally. First woman of color in the history of the Commonwealth to ever be elected a district attorney. And I say those things not because it has anything to do with me, but there are certain voices that have never been heard in the seat that I'm sitting in right now. You might hear us as the mother or sister or partner of a potential criminal defendant, but it's a very different chorus coming or voice coming from the seat of a district attorney. And what I've done is I've written a policy memo that I think we took a lot of time on, and we explained and we have trained our staff rigorously regarding that policy memo. And we talk about implicit bias and disparities in race and wealth, and how they weave themselves throughout many of our societal systems, and the criminal legal system is one of those. I have personally addressed my staff in a letter that ultimately I did put out to the public, but regarding the murders of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor, which, you know, sparked what I would say is one of the largest sort of civil rights and human rights reactions that we've seen, certainly in my lifetime, regarding injustice. And we've asked for input from people. We've had restorative justice circles. We've had trainings. We just have to continue the conversation. And what we aren't going to allow is people's uncomfort to stop us from doing that.
At the top, when we were talking about the Supreme Judicial Court, you commented that there aren't any criminal defense attorneys on the court, and that might be something to consider. I want to pick up on that thread. I have one last question to ask you, because we're going to lose you in about a minute here. A WBUR investigation recently found that at least three of the 11 Massachusetts DAs keep Brady lists. These are lists of police officers whose past conduct might damage their credibility in court and require disclosures to defense counsel. Your office keeps one of those lists. You've said you plan to make the list of officers public on September 25th, which is a week from Friday. Are you still on track for that? Is that something we should be watching for on the 25th?
You bet. You should. And we have said out loud that we are going to be reaching out to the CPCS and MACDL, so the Anthony Benedetti, the chief counsel there, as well as the Mass Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys, the ACLU, and Lawyers for Civil Rights. We know that there are exceptional members of law enforcement that do an honorable and noble job every day with dignity and compassion and cultural competence. Unfortunately, the media is not showing us those images every day. We are seeing the individuals that are not, you know, that are dishonoring the badge, right? The Derek Chauvins of the world are the ones that are uplifted, unfortunately, or that we are seeing in the media. When
the
we see nine Boston police officers, right, indicted, that makes us lose our credibility in the system. And I mean us. I'm a member of law enforcement now as the DA. So we are holding these individuals accountable. Of course, it was the U.S. attorney and the special agent in charge of the FBI that did, because they were federal charges. But we feel obligated to tell the criminal defense bar about this. Now, of course, they've probably seen the news, but on my letterhead saying, if you have concerns about any of these nine individuals, if they have been involved in criminal cases, we will review any pleading that you present to us that calls to question their potential bias or ability to be truthful, right? So this is information that we are adding into our lead database, but we also want to take an additional step and notify MACDL, CPCS, ACLU, and the Lawyers for Civil Rights. And we are going to be continuing to do that.
Just to clarify for listeners, you're talking about the recent arrest of nine police officers involved in overtime scandal at the Boston Police Department, correct?
Correct. That is what I was speaking of.
And when you release that list, we would love to have you come back on air and talk about it. I hope you'll join us for that.
You bet. I will absolutely
be
on. And I am proud that there are other DAs that are doing this as well.
That is Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins. Thanks for joining us today.
Okay.
The state is stepping in to take the lead in contact tracing at Boston College. Here's Governor Charlie Baker speaking about the decision to bring in the state contact tracing initiative at a press conference yesterday.
In this particular case, Boston College had campuses in three different communities. That's a lot of handoffs. And one of the things we talked to them about, which they agreed to do, and so did the three communities they operate in, was to make the contact tracing collaborative, which can handle multi-jurisdictional places more effectively. The overseer of the tracing program associated with the BC program.
Now, that move comes amidst growing criticism of the college's coronavirus strategy. The school has reported 115 positive tests since mid-August, with more than half of those happening last week. According to Boston College, the rate of new positive tests has since fallen off significantly. So here to discuss is the leader of one of the communities that BC touches, Newton. This is Newton Mayor Ruth Ann Fuller. Mayor Fuller, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So, Mayor Fuller, you've been very critical of BC's testing and safety plans. How are you reacting to the news that the state is stepping in to coordinate?
I'm thrilled that Mary Lou Sutters, the secretary, and the governor moved quickly. The city of Newton had requested that oversight be transferred from Boston College to the Community Tracing Collaborative on Saturday, and by Monday it was done. We're thrilled.
So we talked to Jack Dunn from Boston College on Monday, and we reached out to BC in advance of today, in advance of this segment. They're stressing that they're a very active and willing partner in the initiative. I actually want to read you a part of their statement. Quote, "We are still conducting our contact tracing, and it has worked well for us in quickly identifying individuals on our campus who were in close contact with those who tested positive. But we are happy to work in collaboration with the state and with the local municipalities," end quote. What's your reaction to their statement?
We very much need Boston College to be an active partner with the health departments here in Newton, in Brookline, and in Boston, as well as as well as with the state. So that's good news that they're committed to doing that.
They point out that their positive test numbers are dropping. They've reported 5 new cases this week, down from 73 cases last week. Do you consider that an indication that their strategy for testing and containment is working?
So let's parse the numbers a little bit. Yes, last week was 73, but they're only a day and a half into this week. So those 5 new cases, as I look at it, they've had 78 positive cases in an 8 or 9 day period. And I'm all with BC. If their numbers drop, I'll be thrilled.
What are you hearing from residents of Newton?
So we're hearing that residents understand that Boston College is integrally connected to Newton. Their students, as well as faculty and staff, they live here, they shop here, they dine and drink here, they play sports here, and they work here. And we've had such a tremendous work by our residents to have such low levels of transmission and a low positivity rate. They are concerned that this spike at a community that's right here in Newton could impact us. Remember that their numbers go into our numbers. Their students are our neighbors, and we're trying so hard to reopen our schools in person, get our restaurants and retailers back on their feet, and our residents back to work. So everyone wants their numbers to be very low.
Mayor Fuller, this has been a little tense. On Saturday, you met with BC administrators. Over the weekend, you called for BC to transfer contact tracing to municipal health departments for students who live in Newton. I live in Newton. I saw your email Saturday night expressing grave concern about what was happening at BC and how they were handling it. Are you satisfied now? Does this approach by the state now satisfy the concerns you were expressing over the weekend?
I think it's an important step, because now the case investigation and the contact tracing will be very transparent for all the communities involved. If these numbers still are spiking, we need BC to reconsider their testing strategy and the amount of testing they do, and make sure that they can isolate and quarantine their students, whether undergrads or graduate students or on or off campus students, that they can do that on their campus.
Do you believe it was appropriate for BC to open in person and bring students back to campus?
So it's you can open in person if all the major pillars of mitigation are in place. You need mask wearing, you need 6 feet of physical distancing, you need to de-densify your classrooms, you need to make sure that people aren't mixing with lots of other people in informal settings. And it's hard, but it is doable. But when you have a situation where all of a sudden there's a spike, when there's a cluster, you have to act swiftly. This is a very contagious disease.
I want to ask you, on our show Monday, BC spokesman Jack Dunn accused you of politicizing the issue of the coronavirus on the BC campus. And he went on to note that relations between you and Boston College have been tense, going back to the eminent domain dispute over Webster Woods. How do you respond to that?
Well, some people in Washington, D.C. are politicizing COVID-19. That's not what we do in Massachusetts, and that's not what we do in Newton. Here in Newton, we look at the data. We review testing protocols. We evaluate contact tracing and case investigation methodologies. Our goal is to flatten the curve and to keep it flat. Boston College is an important part of our Newton community. We're invested in their success, and we are investing in their success.
So with that in mind, what is next for Boston College in Newton?
I'll continue to work closely with them. Yes, we definitely had a bump in the road about Webster Woods, where Father Leahy saw that land as critical to BC's future. But I knew it was critical to ours. We will make sure that we can do everything we can to keep their students and faculty healthy. And I look forward to continuing to collaborate with them in the years ahead.
That is Newton Mayor Ruth Ann Fuller. Mayor Fuller, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So listening into that conversation was WBUR Edify reporter Max Larkin. Max joined us on Monday when we talked to Boston College as well. Welcome back, Max.
Thanks for having me back.
So let me start with your initial reactions to what we heard from Mayor Fuller.
Well, I think she sounded genuinely relieved, Tiziana, that there's going to be a little more information sharing, a little more collaboration. But notably, she did not say she was satisfied when you asked. She said important step, but it seemed like she wasn't yet sure BC has beat the outbreak they were facing. Notably, the university still hasn't delivered on two of her requests, those being the pledge not to put students who have tested positive into facilities in Newton, or on a commitment to bump up testing across the board. So I hear her as pleased, but not satisfied, I guess.
And Max, do you read the state stepping in here in this coordinating role as a response to all this criticism?
I think you kind of have to, right? Like this is a way that BC can take a step forward and be a bit more open to the world outside. But I think the context matters. You know, there are communities at the periphery that are concerned that something they're working really hard to contain on a municipal level might bubble out of control on a private campus. So this feels like a way for BC to say, we are voluntarily participating in a better response without fundamentally compromising their plan for the fall.
And is the state contact tracing initiative intervening to coordinate this way at any other college or university, or is this just BC?
It is not doing this, that I am aware of. Then again, there really hasn't been an outbreak as sort of notable at the area's big universities. So they may not have had cause to. It's important to note, I think the CDC, the tracing collaborative, is itself kind of a creature of universities, right? Harvard School of Public Health played a role in getting it going. And then campus biology and health departments are involved on the back end. They're parsing data. They're looking for these contacts. I think generally these universities were and are going to be left alone if they think they can handle their tracing on their own. But in this case, BC, I guess, decided, it needed the help.
Max, what kind of reactions are you hearing today? Have you talked to students, community members, faculty? What are you hearing?
Yeah, I'd say generally there's still a little anxiety over in Chestnut Hill, be that among staff and students. I spoke to Jack Goldman, who's a student journalist, a senior at BC. He's very, very neutral. He takes that campus role pretty seriously. But Goldman told me that if he had to guess, he'd say most of his classmates would not be totally reassured by the fact that the state is now, taking this role on.
Buffing up contact tracing is not going to solve the discomfort students feel on campus. We're in contact with each other when we go to class, no matter what. I'm not sure it really solves the core issue, which is, should we be here? Under this plan, are we good to be here?
So, Tiziana, students have called and are still calling, as Mayor Fuller did, for just more tests on a daily basis, a model closer to the one being followed at Boston University or at Northeastern. Goldman thought that if BC administrators decide not to budge on that and keep testing at the level that they're doing, students might turn their attention to off-campus enforcement, which is striking many people as a problem area at the university. Lots of BC students live off-campus, including a majority of their third-year students. And there's little that the university can do as of today to monitor their behavior, be sure they're being safe.
Max, you heard me talk to Mayor Fuller about the fact that there were over the 70 cases last week. The BC's reporting 5 this week, and her response to that was kind of, well, the week isn't over yet. So what is the state of the outbreak at Boston College right now?
You know, it's partly a function of how BC reports data. We get these really granular day-by-day slices at BU and Northeastern, a function of their plan. BC's own data is emerging more slowly. You know, 3 times a week you get a little update and you have to do some kind of math to figure out what's going on. But I think looking at that data and an independent dashboard that was put together, I guess, by some alumni, show that the daily positivity rate on average is way down again at BC after this alarming spike, which was now 10 days ago. For now, it's kind of hovering 1-2%, maybe a little less than 1%, which ought to make all the tracing easier if it holds at that level. Then again, that rate is still 10 times higher than the one they're reporting at BU at Northeastern. So it's not as if they've totally returned to the pace being set by other big private colleges.
Well, we're going to continue to watch this with you, WBUR EDIFY reporter Max Larkin. Thanks, Max.
Thank you.
We had a lot of haze up there today, a lot of smoke, and that was all due to wildfires out west.
It's these huge amounts of smoke coming from out west. They go up high in the sky and the jet stream winds.
Some of the most extreme cases out west, the smoke actually filters out parts of visible light, giving that orangish Martian look to the sky.
Notice that hazy sky these last few days? Well, you heard it correctly. It is smoke from the massive wildfires on the west coast, which has made its way all the way to New England. On top of extraterrestrial skies, we are coming out of the hottest summer on record here in Massachusetts. Down south, Hurricane Sally is bearing down on the Florida coast, with tropical storms Teddy and Vicky forming in the Atlantic. Meteorologists say we are barely halfway through an unusually active Atlantic hurricane season, and there is only one name left, Wilfred, on the 21 name list used for storms. Climate change has exacerbated West Coast droughts and the intensity, duration, and impact of hurricanes on the South Coast, so we want to take stock on how these climate change fuel events resonate here in New England. We've got 2 guests to do that. First, joining us is Michael Rollins. He's an associate professor at UMass Amherst and associate director of the school's Climate System Research Center. Hello, Michael.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Glad to have you. I'm also glad to welcome Ibrahim Lopez Hernandez, a climate justice organizer with Green Roots. Green Roots is an environmental justice organization based in Chelsea, Massachusetts. Welcome to you as well, Ibrahim.
Hi, Tiziana. Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. And listeners, we're glad to have you too. Have you noticed the smoke in the sky this week? Are you worried about the long tail of these climate fuel events for us here in New England and the larger climate change concerns we know we're facing? How are you feeling about it? What are you thinking about it? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael, I will turn to you first. What do these hazy skies, this orange 6 a.m. over New England, signal to you?
Well, what these fires signal to me is that there's something very unusual going on out west. And it's not uncommon for us to see hazy skies like this from fires in the west. Typically, western Canada, often in the summertime, there'll be large fires. But the degree of fire burning out west right now is what's most alarming. And what we're seeing this summer in the fires out west is really just part and parcel of what's happening to our environment. And particularly out west, the warming has been exacerbated by a decades-long drought. And that's just providing ample conditions for this trend toward there's essentially been about a 5-fold increase in wildfires out in the western U.S. And this is Michael, consistent with our understanding of climate warming.
So before I turn to Ibrahim, one more question for you on that. We did just have the hottest summer on record and what's been called a not-so-normal fire season in Massachusetts. And you got the report out from the National Center for Atmospheric Research on how a rapidly warming Arctic will impact us. Longer winter storms, longer heat waves. How do we wrap our head around so much change all at once? Is this an alarming amount of change?
It does seem like an alarming amount of change in such a short amount of time. When you spoke about the tropical systems in the Atlantic, were record number of storms, our record warm summer here in Massachusetts, and we can expect these climate impacts will just continue on in the future, given our amount of burning of fossil fuels and the limited amount of mitigation we're doing right now. We really have to adapt to these changes, particularly across eastern Massachusetts. Sea level rise is one of the most impactful things we're going to be experiencing in years to come.
Listeners, share your concerns and questions, too, on the impact of these climate events that we're seeing around the world, how they affect us in New England, and what our future is like here. 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Ibrahim, this haze in the sky, hottest summer on record. These are the impacts of a changing climate. All of us can feel them or see them in a visceral way. But in a community like Chelsea, the impacts of climate change are really being felt every day. How are you reacting to these changes that Michael and I have been talking about? And how's your organization reacting?
Yeah, so Chelsea has been feeling the impacts of climate change for years. And now with COVID, it's even more exacerbated, and we've been able to see it even more since we have a lot of essential workers, for example. A lot of them have to be outside. And during the summer, it was extraordinarily hot. So urban heat island climate impacts have really been felt. And for example, Green Roots has partnered with Boston University in trying to address how urban heat island is affecting our essential workers in Chelsea and see how their health is being impacted and what are the pros, the cons, and the barriers to actually having a healthy life. So that's one of the key things that we've been working on this summer. We're also trying to address sea level rise, which is another big component for the Boston area, trying to expand our green space, our parks, so that our low-income residents can also have equitable access to these benefits, and also trying to protect our infrastructure. We have the largest PROTA center, and there are a lot of essential workers also working there, and that's also directly threatened by climate impacts.
And what are you hearing from residents, Ibrahim?
So right now it's very difficult for a lot of families who still have work, who have the privilege of still having work, trying to maintain a healthy lifestyle. Maybe they were used to walking outside or trying to get some exercise, for example, and now they have to be inside due to COVID, except for going to work. Mm-hmm. Most of them can't afford air conditioners or maybe don't have air conditioning. And so there's a very big economic barrier to trying to keep cool when they used to do it outside and would rely on those public resources such as parks. So there are a lot of barriers in trying to keep healthy, and our old housing stock and the very old infrastructure that we have in place doesn't help either.
Let's grab a couple calls here, 800-423-8255. We've got Josh on the line from Brighton. Josh, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up the observation that I made is that this just goes to show how interconnected the entire country as well as the globe is in this fight against climate change, and how a fire out in California can affect people in here or out here in the West or the East Coast. And I think it's really just amazing.
Thanks for the call, Josh. I'm going to add one more caller voice. We've got Bill on the line from Ashby. Bill, go ahead.
Hi, I live in Groton. I'm just out taking a drive. It's such a nice day. And I'm struck with how few trees have changed. They're all green. There's hardly any color. And I think it's because, as you said, it was the hottest summer on record.
Well, let's turn to Michael about that, Bill, and then we'll go back and pick up the question about interconnected and how we go forward together here. Is that why the trees are still green, Michael? Do we know?
I believe it's my understanding that we're just a little bit early to be seeing the leaves change out here, that we're expecting that is a little bit more toward early October, my understanding.
So not necessarily a sign of global warming or the kind of heat we had this summer.
No, but what we are seeing, though, is you see a lot of drought stress in a lot of the vegetation. So with a record warm summer, you have a very high evaporative demand. The atmosphere is basically thirsty. So if we look at the measure of how much evaporation from the surface this summer, it was really, really tremendous. And with this short-term drought we've had a lot of really stress for the vegetation in this area.
And Ibrahim, you know, Josh said, hey, we are all in this together. This shows how interconnected we are and that we're going to have to act together. Are you finding allies and support outside of Chelsea? And how are you plugged into the larger green movement? You know, and what are the next steps you're working toward?
Yeah, so Green Roots has been in extensive talks and has been collaborating with a range of different stakeholders in Massachusetts, for example. One of the key things that we've been doing is working towards a state legislature bill to try to identify and actually recognize that there are environmental justice communities, for example, which would really bring out the necessary recognition that Chelsea and other geographies such as East Boston, that they are very, very vulnerable to climate impacts, for example, and that there are very specific barriers to that and injustices happening. We're also trying to collaborate with a roundtable on the Green New Deal and also having conversations there. So we're also reaching out and getting ideas and sharing ideas to try to help Massachusetts.
Do you have good partners in Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, Governor Charlie Baker, the Massachusetts State House?
So we've been having conversations, and that's specifically Maria Belen, who has been on the legislative level. But in terms of on the ground bootstraps with the city of Chelsea and also the city of Boston, we've been having conversations and planning towards how to best center our efforts and not doubling them, and then addressing, for example, sea level rise, our urban heat island effects, and trying to make people have better livelihoods in that sense. So we're definitely in conversations, and we're collaborating with our city stakeholders.
Michael, sometimes with these big systems level dynamics, processes, I find myself just wanting to ask somebody, how bad is it? So here in the Commonwealth, the threat for us of climate change right now, the impacts we're already seeing in these hot summers and the drought, et cetera, you know, how bad is it?
Well, it's been getting worse, and it's going to get worse in the future. I think that's the thing we need to keep in mind is we have an ability to mitigate some of the warming if we act. And I should mention that the Northeast U.S., unfortunately, is one of the fastest warming parts of the U.S., and that's expected to continue. By the time the global average temperature reaches 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial, which it will likely do later this century, the Northeast U.S. will have warmed by likely 3 degrees Celsius. So some of these impacts we see are seeing now are only going to get worse. It's really, really imperative that our elected officials act in order to mitigate the upcoming impacts we're expected to see that only get worse with time.
Let's pick up one more caller here, 800-423-8255. We've got Jean on the line from Brookline. Hi, Jean, go ahead.
Hello. I'd like to make the point. I'm a citizen of Brazil, and I do live in Brookline, Massachusetts. I'd like to make the point about how governments in such this vibrant nations with so much natural resources, such as Brazil, the United States, Mexico, and how corruption is so intertwined with bad policy in this country, failing us and failing our environment as well.
Thank you for that, Jean. I don't want to pick up on the corruption thread, but I do want to pick up on the government thread. This week during a meeting in California, officials there pushed the president to acknowledge the role of climate change in the wildfires. And the president said, quote, "It'll start getting cooler. You just watch," end quote. Climate change has not been a big part of his agenda. Were that to continue to be the case, we're in an election year. Ibrahim, Michael, can state and local leaders make up the difference if federal leaders are not taking action? Can this be a coalition of states in the United States who can make forward progress? Michael.
I think that states and local officials are stepping up and are doing their part. There's obviously some limits to what can be done at more local levels, but it's my understanding that a lot of places are acting to adapt and to mitigate. And in the absence of more effective, if you will, federal leadership, I think it's important that states and local officials who do recognize the impacts and what we're seeing to act in the best interest of their constituents.
Ibrahim, I want to follow up on that question with you and bring the coronavirus into this context as well. We know that Chelsea is a community that has been disproportionately affected by the virus. We know that there are serious environmental justice issues for Chelsea as well. One of the things that we've heard people talk about in the last 6 months is the level of collective action we've been able to achieve in response to the virus and how that compares with the struggle to achieve that collective action on climate change. How do you think about that?
Well, I think that the coronavirus crisis that has hit East Boston and Chelsea Everett particularly hard is a good proxy, a good example of how we could come together and focus on climate change. With all the difficulties to try to help our residents, we've still managed to rally up with allies and try to help them as best we can, especially immigrants, our immigrant community who doesn't have the same access to benefits. For example, we managed to get $1.5 million through a very big recollection effort to help everybody in Chelsea. So I think that that is a very good framework to try to see how we can bring that towards climate change and then being able to have actual change on the ground.
Ibrahim, I just want to acknowledge we're having a little bit of line quality issue. I just want to acknowledge that for listeners in the background there. I think the thing I'd want to ask the two of you last, this is overwhelming, it's scary, it's urgent. Where do you find hope and see the most resilience right now? Michael, I'll invite you to go first.
I see a lot of hope in the increasing number of Americans, if you will, that recognize that our climate's changing and that are interested in seeing solutions posed and that they really accept the signs. It's really been encouraging the last few years to see that trend. And I think that's where our hope lies, in the fact that many of us are recognizing this threat and are willing to accept solutions that will get us closer to carbon neutral, which we need in order to start lowering our carbon concentrations in the atmosphere. So that gives me a lot of hope.
Ibrahim, how about you? And I'll note, I thought this was really interesting. You moved to Massachusetts from Puerto Rico after the devastating 2018 Hurricane Maria. Where are you finding resilience and hope?
I think that I'm finding hope with seeing how motivated our residents and organizations are in trying to rally around addressing climate change, even with the absence of federal guidance and help. Coming from Puerto Rico and having lived through Hurricane Maria and actually seeing how bad it could get, it's a motivating factor. Having that experience is exactly what I want to avert now that I'm having my life here in Massachusetts. And yeah. Very excited to try to help out with that experience.
I'm glad to hear that. That's Ibrahim Lopez Hernandez, a climate justice organizer with Green Roots. Green Roots is an environmental justice organization based in Chelsea, Massachusetts. Ibrahim, thank you.
Thank you.
And Michael Rollins, an associate professor at UMass Amherst and associate director of the school's Climate System Research Center. Michael, thanks to you too.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.